Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
The following program may contain potty talk. No guarantee, but it just may. It's Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. November 3rd, wait, it's Election Day. Or the end of the election days. Or the end of times. In Pennsylvania, it's the day they can start processing the ballots they've had sitting around for weeks. And at least seven Pennsylvania counties, according to NBC, plan to hold off processing or counting their ballots until the very end of Election Day. Why not? To quote a member of Fancy Bear, what a country. Though in effect, what a collection of states with greatly varying systems that somehow come together and elect a leader of a country by 51 different sets of rules. But look, it all makes sense, right? I mean, Pennsylvania, they have the vote, lots of vote, pre-vote. They won't touch it. They won't look at it. They won't process it. And that's how they do everything in Pennsylvania, right? That's how they worked the forge and the mines. All the other stuff is done. You get your stuff that you have to do. You line it up, but you don't do it. You don't do it until the day that it is due. It is the way of the Pennsylvanian. We're in Ohio or Florida. In Florida, they set about their tasks as soon as the task is assigned, because that is the difference between how a Floridian and a Pennsylvanian conducts his or her business, and that is why it is so accurately reflected in the election law. Can you imagine if we enforced the ways of the Floridian, actually counting the vote beforehand on the Pennsylvanian? That would be oppressive. Does any of this make sense? It does not. But it is the best system besides all others, except if you look at every other mature democracy. It's worse than pretty much all of them. Okay, it's not perfect, but we've muddled through. Except we haven't really, and we might not in the future. And we did need a goddamn civil war to sort out some of the really fundamental flaws. All I'm saying is we have a terrible system. We all pretty much knew we had a terrible system. And still, every time I vote, I sport that I voted sticker right there on my chest. And I think to myself, it does say I voted, but what it should say is I just supported the best ideas some guys in the 18th century could think of. Best ideas defined as the actual best ideas that weren't too off-putting to a powerful constituency of slave owners. You're right, I voted. It's much more pithy. Fits on the sticker a lot better. In all honesty, if I could just choose one reform, either a choice, replace the electoral college system with the one person, one vote, real way of democracy, okay, so that's my choice, or I could totally reform this hodgepodge of state systems and just go to a universally applied best practices of voting with early voting and plenty of access and counting ballots received before Election Day when they come in and plenty of polls and no voter ID laws. It would be much preferable to have the latter. The Electoral College skews the results some, but all the other ridiculous state-decided, court-approved restrictions, they're actually more onerous and more an encumbrance to actually divining the actual will of the people. Anyway, that's my process argument for today. As for who I am voting for, as you know, I am a one-issue voter. The issue is showerhead efficiency, pressure per square inch. That's it. Make America wet again. You know, even beyond that, if I were more than a one-issue voter, there's really a whole suite of appliance concerns that I think one candidate addresses pretty well.
Toilets and showers. You don't get any water. They put restrictors on and now they made them permanent. People used to take them out. But how about the shower? You go into a shower, and I have this beautiful head of hair. I need a lot of water. And you go into the shower, right? You turn on the water. Drip. 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 So we're getting rid of the restrictors. You're going to have full shower flow.
And also this one.
People are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once.
So you know where my interests lay, and I'm not going to fib. I'm also really concerned with a sculpture park of American heroes. and I would like to see some hurricanes nuked. But I'm not going to tell you who I voted for. Perhaps you can infer, but such is my regard for the sanctity of the ballot that I won't just say it. The ballot, the precious, meaningless, in 35 states, the relic of the benighted but well-intentioned past ballot. Well, I do say better the ballot box than the bayonet, and a powerfully flushing toilet is the highest ideal of all. I should mention, if you hear this at, say, dusk before polls are closed, I will be on an election night show sponsored by On the Media at 8 and 10. Information is, I guess, in our channel. Just Google it, On the Media election night, you know, NPR, On the Media, Brooke and Bob. And there's also a show conducted by the Comedy Cellar, because that is where I go to get my election news. Also tomorrow, Virginia Heffernan of TrumpCast and I will be doing a Slate Live show, or day after the election, or whatever we call the last day of the election, whatever we're calling it. And the theme will be, what happened, or why is it still happening? On the show today, I tell you what's at stake beyond who actually wins. The ideas, the competing ideas of elections and democracy and credibility of your fellow citizen. Some of the things at stake. But first, no matter who wins, because who knows who will win by the time you hear this, I wanted to focus on one idea that's been roiling. And that is the question, are we trending toward autocracy? I mean, depending on the vote tonight, will we get a yes or a no? How much of a referendum will be issued? Yasha Monk, the podcast host and persuasion impresario, co-wrote an article 4 years ago, and he laid out three criteria. And he says that one of the criteria, openness to military rule, America was experiencing that. And polls were also showing that we don't value living in a democracy. That was another of the criteria. And he said, we seem to be trending towards an autocracy. Other academics have put forward different checklists, but I shall talk with not an academic, but a thinker, a writer, and someone who currently lives in a country that is trending or has trended toward autocracy. Anne Applebaum, the author of Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, joins me next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvell. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. So today is a big day. You probably know that. We will decide something. Who shall be president from 2021 through, I don't know, maybe 4 years. That's what the Constitution says. But we're going to decide something else. We could be deciding something akin to the fate of the system. I don't want to be too dramatic about it, but smart people who look at such things and chronicle the rise of autocracies might look at a day like today as something of a fulcrum. The day where it was decided, it might take a week, but the time it was decided, really, if this country is going to be a more or less functioning democracy or a less functioning autocracy. Anne Applebaum is the author of Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. She writes for The Atlantic. She knows of whence she speaks, living as she does in Poland, a country that went from communist rule to burgeoning democracy to slipping back to autocracy. And welcome back to The Gist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you worried?
I'm worried. I'm worried not just because of the result of the election. I'm worried by the language that's been used in the run-up to this election. I'm worried by the Trump campaign's denigration of the voting process. I'm worried by Trump himself implying that the election might be faked or stolen. I'm worried by the amount of disinformation on the internet that is persuading people that ballots are being stolen or mailed twice. I'm worried about the use of intimidation tactics against people who are voting. I'm worried by the long lines at a lot of polling stations across America. Those are all things that I find really worrying.
This, what you just said, gets to exactly to the crux of why I wanted to have you on, which is this. Today we decide. So if the voters, knowing this and seeing how Trump acts and maybe not knowing the labels, but getting a sense of the stakes, if voters put him back in office or if he somehow gets reelected by hook or crook, that's an affirmation of the autocratic tendencies. But if voters reject him and resoundingly reject him, then isn't it an affirmation that it could have been an autocracy? It was rejected by the system, and not that we have nothing to worry about, but that we chose the other path, and therefore all of this worry was in the service of giving a presentation, having it rejected, in a big way affirming that the system is healthy.
So I would like to agree with that. And I agree with the premise of what you just said, which is that the result will tell us interesting things about Americans. Unfortunately, though, I think even if Biden wins, and even if he wins by a large number, we are still left with the fact that a very significant number of Americans, I don't know whether the number is going to be 35% or 45% or 49%, whatever, accepted Trump's attacks on democracy, his ethical lapses, his abuse of government institutions, his abuse of American foreign policy even. They've accepted those things. And very often, because they hate the other side so much, and that's very often the reason, I know that it's not the only reason, they have decided to vote for him anyway. Poll after poll after poll has shown that Americans' support for democracy and faith in democracy has been slipping over the last number of years. The numbers are quite remarkable generationally. Older people, when you ask them the polling question, do you think it's essential to live in a democracy? I mean, the vast majority of Americans say yes. When you go down and you ask younger people, the numbers drop pretty remarkably. And this election, I think no matter how it comes out, is going to be the proof of that. In other words, that for a lot of Americans, Trump's assault on democratic institutions just don't matter as much as other things. And that is a bad sign for the future. And it's an indication that we need to take the deterioration of democracy very seriously, and that a new administration, whether it's, you know, next week or 4 years from now, needs to look at a range of institutions, from the way we vote to the way that we're taught civic education to the way that our political system works. All these things should be up for grabs and up for debate, because too many Americans just don't think democracy is important anymore.
And if he wins a second term, I think tangibly we've heard reporting on who's he going to fire, basically everyone who doesn't agree with him totally, and what's going to be the check on him. It seems none. But how does he make the country more autocratic than what he did in the first term? I mean, the court's already 6-3 Republican.
Yes. So I think, yes, I mean, the courts will, you know, the courts will be majority Republican for many generations to come. But I don't think the courts are really what matters here. I would watch instead what he does to the civil service. So the politicization of government science, for example, regulatory agencies, you know, climate agencies, the replacement of anybody with neutral or apolitical qualifications, whether it's in the Department of Energy or the Food and Drug Administration or the CDC or the, you know, Health and Human Services, anybody who's there because they have qualifications or scientific knowledge will now be at risk of being thrown out, to be replaced by a placeholder, a friend of the family, somebody's cousin. And those will be the people who fill the arms of American government. And that will, I think, very rapidly change the way that we live in lots of probably ways that we don't expect. I mean, much as the playing out of the coronavirus happened in ways that we don't expect, you can expect other kinds of catastrophes to follow the abuse of the way the Justice Department works. It will no longer be an institution that is created to, that is designed to enforce the law as it is written. Instead, it will be an institution that's designed to protect and defend the Trump family. And I would also look very closely at, you know, some of the signs that we've seen in the last few weeks. So will American elections continue to be free? How much farther will the voter suppression go? So, you know, you will continue to see the political system erode in large and small ways. And I imagine there will be the kinds of, you know, health crises, pollution crises, you know, other crises that will result from the dismantling of our of the regulatory agencies that will continue well into the future.
So from your knowledge of countries that have been through something like this, if it is the case that Donald Trump gets elected again, and it doesn't seem like he could do so with actually the majority of the votes, and as we said, a large percentage of our coalition are not actually thrilled by his autocratic tendencies. So let's say he just has a portion of a minority that are really thrilled by him governing as an autocrat. Then would he be an autocrat? Does he have to have the will of the people behind him in the exact project of autocracy to be considered an autocrat? Or can he just be an autocrat by changing enough of the rules, governing as he pleases, and, you know, staying in office?
Well, remember that by definition, most autocrats don't have full popular support.
Well, not full. I mean, but I don't really believe the public opinion polls in Russia totally, but I believe them to some extent. Like, it seems like maybe not in the last few months, but Putin does seem more popular than not, and Orban does seem more popular than not.
Yes, but those are both, and you know, and those are both interesting cases. Those are both political systems where the rules have been changed. I mean, it is impossible for opposition to win, and the rules governing media, the rules governing the courts, whether opposition politicians are allowed to stand or not. So in other words, those are political systems in which no opposition is allowed to emerge. So, but the point is that once Trump is elected, I would say one of the great dangers is that he's elected, you know, by the Electoral College, but not with the popular vote, in which case we then have a different kind of problem, which is that a significant proportion of the country feels cheated, you know, not just once, but a second time. And a significant number of people on the left and maybe elsewhere begin to feel that voting doesn't matter, that democratic procedures aren't working. And this is, it's always in those kinds of political circumstances that you begin to get political violence. And that is another outcome I would fear if Trump wins the Electoral College, but not the popular vote.
If Joe Biden wins, there's going to be a call to, there's already a call to either investigate Trump or Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In my opinion, he has said the right things about, I guess, what we would call a middle ground, which is if there's evidence, we won't stop the Justice Department or other investigators from looking at it, but we're not going to specifically establish that. But let's talk about, if Biden wins, the equivalent for the electoral processes. I think that there will be a little bit of impetus. Look, we won. That proves we don't really need this huge overhaul. The wisdom of the American people. Believe in the system. There's a danger to that as I hear you talking. So what do you think the Democrats, if they do control different branches of government, should push for? And what would be the right thing to do? What would be the politically expedient? Not what would be the politically smart thing to do? And what would be the best thing to do in terms of preserving the democracy long term?
So I think the politically smart thing to do, and this will be, by the way, be unpopular among a lot of Democrats, the politically smart thing to do is to continue to do as the Biden campaign has tried to do over the last few weeks, is to continue to reach out to the American center and to keep speaking to political opponents, people on the moderate right, people who didn't vote for Joe Biden, and keep asking them what they want and keep trying to incorporate their views into whatever changes are made. Above all, I would say the smart thing is to concentrate on real issues. And by real issues, I mean, you know, fixing finally the healthcare system, helping the economy recover from the pandemic, focusing on things that affect people's real lives, and at least, you know, at least, you know, for a good chunk of time, staying out of the culture wars. It's the culture wars between left and right that polarize people, that make people angry, and produce the kind of politics that lead people to violence and push people towards extremism. And the more that the Biden administration can focus on real things that affect real people's lives and the real economy, the better. I mean, I would argue that there will be a time, I don't know whether it be 6 months into the administration or a year into the administration, when it will be time to start talking about ways in which we could reform some elements of democracy, finding ways to talk creatively. I mean, there are so many boring conversations that people have about civic education. Why don't we have it? A presidential White House push for finding ways of bringing more Americans into the conversation, not just gathering public opinion, not just doing polls, but offering people ways of contributing to public debate in a way that makes people feel they're part of the democracy and they don't just show up once every 4 years. I mean, some of those issues, addressing some of those, as I say, once the big real life issues are solved or at least are being dealt with, this would be a really important way for the Biden administration to set about healing this terribly polarized country.
Okay. So let's say Trump wins. He does his purge, Esper's gone, Ray's gone, Haspel's gone. He does what you say to the civil servants, and terrible things are visited upon us because of his just total dismissal of norms and autocratic tendencies. But then he's voted out of office, and let's say a Democrat wins or even the very reformist Republican. Would we look back and then say it was an autocracy? I mean, do autocracies operate that way, that the strong man gets power and there is an actual election and is just voted either out of power or term limited out?
I mean, now you're asking me to do a crystal ball thing and tell you what's going to happen 4 years from now. And I'm not good at that.
No. But if it does happen, can we say all these thoughts of autocracy per se weren't unwarranted, but it didn't come to pass in the way it has in many other countries?
So the issue is not whether Trump will stay there indefinitely. I mean, the magic of age would end his political career sooner rather than later. You know, the issue is whether he will be capable of skewing the system. Presumably, by the way, if he wins, then the Republicans keep the Senate and there are other ways in which they're able to stay in power. But the question is whether he can do enough to skew our political system so that it permanently benefits the Republican Party, the current, in its current form. The question is whether the kinds of judges they can appoint, whether the kinds of laws they can pass, whether they can, make it more difficult for anyone to defeat them in the future, because that's what we're talking about. It's not so much his personal fate or how long he stays there. The question is how deeply does he damage the system? I mean, democracy requires that every 4 years, a kind of miracle happens, namely someone wins the election and then his political enemies have to say, okay, he has the right to rule for 4 years and we won't stop him. And at the same time, the winner has to say, all right, I'm get to be in power for 4 years, but I have to keep all these, blocks of the system in place for another 4 years so that 4 years from now, my enemies can beat me. And that's actually very, difficult, for many people to wrap their minds around. And the question is whether Trump will try to skew the system to make sure that his party can't lose next time. And this is what we see some Republican governors doing, some Republican state legislatures doing, is trying to fix the system so that their enemies can't win. And that is, by definition, the end of democracy. So that's what you need to be looking for.
Ann Applebaum is author of Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lore of Authoritarianism. And we will know soon, I hope, whether she is correct in her crepuscular prediction, or perhaps we are living in more of a vespertine age. It is, in fact, the dawn of a new democracy, if you can tell that I love those two words and I just needed to shoehorn them in. You are correct. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. A lot more is on the ballot tonight, a lot besides Trump and Biden, or Ernst and Greenfield, Harrison and Graham, QAnon candidate, and Senators Coons or Merkley. A lot more than Mitch McConnell versus his female Air Force pilot challenger, Amy McGrath, or John Cornyn versus his female Marine Corps fighter pilot challenger, MJ Hagar, or astronaut Mark Kelly against the incumbent Republican Air Force fighter pilot Martha McSally, or even the outcome of the Wyoming Senate race between Republican Cynthia Loomis and Democrat Mirov Ben-David, who's the chair of the Department of Zoology at the University of Wyoming, but before that was an Israeli Air Force veteran. So it is more than a referenda on female fighter pilots. And by the way, Teresa Greenfield did fly crop dusters when she was on the farm. I don't mean when I say it's a referendum or a lot will be decided, a lot more is on the ballot. I don't mean things like freedom or decency, though there can be, you know, case can be made that they are on the ballot. I'm speaking about something like worldviews or theories of this democracy. Are we as a nation of moderation or a nation of daring big swings? Are we pessimists? Do we, on the other hand, maybe perpetually hearken to sunny predictions? Americans are uncomfortable with change. You've heard that. Americans are restless and want to tear it all down. You've heard that too. Americans are a practical people. Americans are dreamers. These are the things we say about ourselves, and they're defined by our elections, mostly our presidential elections. Ronald Reagan's Morning in America, Bill Clinton's Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, Barack Obama's Hope and Change. They told us who they were, and in turn, who we were, that all of these candidates won twice, that served as thesis and confirmation, whereas Jimmy Carter's malaise, a word he didn't actually use in his infamous malaise speech, because it was rejected at the polls in 1980, that told us something, too, about the character of the nation, rebuke or confirmation. Trump speaks of American carnage. Trump's reelection will indicate that we agree. His defeat will indicate that we reject. Within the Democratic Party itself, Joe Biden's success or failure will tell us something about the great debate engaged during the nomination process. Something like, is it better to persuade or excite? The more left you were, the more you believed that it was about excitement. It was about turnout. And you equate bolder ideas that break more with the past with excitement. The prospect of having to actually cater to those moderates or those of a middling mindset probably irritates you. Such a mindset retards progress, you think. For 4 years, you could say, if you are of the Bernie backing sort, that it was moderation that hemmed your sales in 2016. But you know, if Joe Biden wins, it will not just be one election that he won, but it will be a theory of how to win elections. Maybe this election will tell us that sometimes you need a white man to beat a white man, right? I don't know. Biden does, however, have Harris as his vice president, and as his chief surrogate, he has Barack Obama. So maybe that it's a coalition of ethnicities. And maybe on the ballot is this coalition of ethnicities better than the overwhelming Caucasianosity of Trump Pence 2020? And by Trump Pence 2020, I mean his 23 person cabinet, of whom 19 are men and 20 are white, or his 218 judges as of July 2020, of whom 85% were white and 76% were men. So an election could be a rebuke to that way of doing business. Depending if Biden wins or Trump wins, we'll get notification about which are the states that are really in play. So Ohio and Florida for most of my life, and we've not really moved off those, but now Georgia and Texas. So before today, Georgia and Texas could have been in play, were said to be purple, a lot of skepticism. But if one of them does go Democratic, that will evoke many possibilities, and the election will tell us what those possibilities are. The economics writer Joe Wiesenthal, writing in The Stalwart, notes, all the experts think Biden is going to win, all the MAGAs think Trump is going to win, and claim that the polls are wrong and biased. High epistemological stakes. Who gets to claim the more accurate perception of reality? Yeah. 2016 was a rebuke to a lot of kinds of knowledge. Climate science, tariff efficacy, healthcare difficulty, virus responsiveness, it turns out. But it was also a rebuke to knowledge in general, to just knowing things versus gut and instinct. It was a referendum on, is data better than the idea that, well, I guess you data guys weren't so smart after all. And it's not just about the pundits, right? It's not just about the surety of pundits and who's really the smart guys. The campaigns themselves tell us what we should think of data. I remember when Barack Obama's team was so smart because he used data. I'll read from a 2012 Washington Post article. The result is a campaign that might be the most micro-targeted in history, attempting to use the power of web and social media to reach ever thinner slices of the electorate. Nearly half of the Obama campaign's March budget, $6.7 million, went towards internet ads, many of them targeting specific demographic or interest groups. Romney has been less aggressive in micro-targeting efforts and has spent only a tenth as much on online advertising. Clever, clever that Obama. He told us it is right to follow the data because his campaign won. And when a campaign wins, it tells us what is right and what is true. Here now is a 2016 article about a candidacy that lost. Democratic operatives lament a one-size-fits-all approach drawn entirely from pre-selected data. Operatives spit out the model, as they complain about it, guiding decisions on field, television, everything else. So data is on the line, or the Trump campaign's gut and instinct. Instinct beats knowledge. Biden wins, data comes roaring back. I'll tell you what other ideas hinge on the result of the elections. Ideas like, it's the economy, or education is the greatest predictor of the vote, or this perennial youthquake we've been promised, or, this is huge, who the real Americans are. Are the real Americans decent people who worry about their family's health during a pandemic? Huh? Or the real Americans, law-abiding citizens who cower in fear that our urban centers are in a state of riot? Are the real Americans correctly suspicious about non-Americans taking jobs when jobs are scarce? Or are the real Americans a coalition of people who embrace diversity, the diversity of new arrivals? It's not just a winning side and a losing side. No, we also find out who was arrogant, because someone's always arrogant. In 2016, it was the media, remember? Yeah, I think it was, because the media, though, discounted the former machinist from Indiana who had something to say, and the media wasn't listening. That part I disagree with. I think the media was listening. It's just that there were a lot of former machinists or those who stood in for him in the voting booth. But in 2008, who was arrogant? Arrogant were the people who were naysayers, who were sure that America was too racist to ever elect a black man. And soon that curdled into the arrogant party being those who mistook a moment that did rebuke one racist data point and convinced themselves that we were moving into a reality that was post-racist. So an election tells us lots of things. In 2020, the top line result will be so meaningful, we might not realize the raft of implications that comes along with it until we start living those realities. A very left member of the Democratic Party will say, no, we need to move the Overton window. And a bunch of people will look at each other, fellow Democrats, and they'll say, well, that's not what the election told us. Or the argument, you smarty pants, you were so wrong last time. That argument will either be wrong or could be doubly powerful. And most of all, we'll be reassured or rebuked about what America means and who our fellow citizens really are, even though upwards of 90% of us haven't changed. And even though the system is not actually designed to deliver an answer to these questions, we can't help but have an election become more than an election. It's a divining rod, or it's a Geiger counter to our national soul, or lack thereof. And that's it for today's show. Margaret Kelly produces The Gist. She believes the election results will be a referendum on if we want a president who says Thailand. Daniel Schrader, Gist producer, thinks the election could contain an affirmation or rebuke of the idea of buying Greenland. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. She thinks the results could tell us if a dogless presidency was always doomed to failure. Has that really been tried? Never been tried. The Gist. Now wondering if the next heated Time Person of the Year debate will be between Donald Trump and a 16-year-old like Greta or maybe Bronny, or will it be between Joe Biden and TikTok star Charli D'Amelio? And tonight, we find out. Oomperoo deperoo dooperoo, and thanks for listening. Is that even how you pronounce Charli D'Amelio? I did ask the kids. I looked it up, and Business Insider had an article. And it said Charli D'Amelio. Hope I got it right.